So it is 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and as always happens at 5 o'clock on Tuesday, it is time for Office Hour. You are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. And it is time now for Office Hour. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And as we do every Tuesday at 5, we're going to knock on someone's door. We're going to find out something about what's going on campus. What are people studying? What are they thinking about? What are they doing inside these buildings? It's always exciting to knock on someone's door and find out what they're studying. So here we go. You can hear the sound. Knock, 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 knock. They're knocking on the door, and I'm very excited today. We're going in slightly a different area of campus than we usually do on this show, and I think there's a lot we're going to be able to learn today. We're knocking on the door of Arnold Bloom from Plant Sciences, okay? So welcome, Arnold.
Thank you for having me.
Right. So this is not my usual humanities-type talk, so we're going to all learn together, and I'm very excited to have Arnold because he's a specialist in trying to help people like me, who took our science classes a long time ago, trying to help us understand issues which I think are quite central, including one we're going to be talking about today, which is climate change. So we'll get going on his research. But before we start on his research and his online class on climate change, we always start with the same question on Office Hour, which is we want to understand how somebody becomes the kind of specialist that they do. So how is it that you became a specialist in the interface between climate and plants in particular? Plenty of people at Davis study plants, right? But how did you become interested in plants?
I became interested not just because of my last name is Bloom.
Okay, okay. Bloom jokes aside.
Yeah, right? Well, we're all predestined for something. But I was a physics major as an undergraduate and studied general relativity and cosmology. And then I became more interested. The environmental movement was becoming a larger issue when I was an undergraduate and became interested in and how, how the environment interacted with living things. After my first year, I was offered a job, and there were no jobs in physics. It was a work study job, and the person in the student job office said, "Would you be interested in biophysics? That's the same as physics, isn't it?" And I said, "I don't know," and so I ended up working in a biophysics lab with a person who was seemed very old at the time, and I realized he was only 30 years old now in hindsight. And he had worked in a lab, and he had actually discovered the genetic code as a postdoc, and he won the Nobel Prize for his major professor. And for his compensation, he got a professorship at the young age of 30, and I was one of the first undergraduates working for him.
So who was that?
Name was Dieter Saul. He was at Yale, and he still is active at Yale. Uh-huh. And his major professor was at University of Wisconsin, and the work he had done as a postdoc for this person won him the Nobel Prize.
Uh-huh.
But he got a professorship as his own reward.
So that seemed like a very interesting way to go then once you met him?
Yeah, and he always would introduce me to the other people in lab as his physicist, and I did a variety of things for him. And he kept on saying, "Are you sure you want to go into physics? Biology is so intriguing, and you can always, you're at a scale where you can always relate to it. With physics, you're always dealing with things that are too massive, too large, too long, or absolutely too short and too small to actually to relate to. Where biology, at its central core, has to deal with things that are at the dimension of our perception."
Uh-huh. And that convinced you?
Yeah. And so I went, I got a strange bit of money after I graduated from my undergraduate degree to go and model the spread of air pollution over Germany.
Hmm.
And ended up working for the German government. They had hired some fancy professor to do these models of air pollution. That professor was taking their money and not doing anything. And here I came with my little backpack. It was actually a big backpack, I walked into their institute and I could do the coding and started looking at how air pollution was spreading over Germany by various sources, and decided I was going to go to graduate school in biology, and ended up going to school in the Bay Area at Stanford. And initially, I was going to do theoretical biology, but as I got into it, I said, well, this is more interesting to actually look at how living things work.
So you looked at these living things, in particular plants. It's interesting to me that you tell this story about going to Germany early on to work on air pollution, because you are interested in climate change, which is also connected to sort of, so you had sort of a trajectory for your whole life leading up to the study, the work that you're doing now. You were already interested in pollution at that early age.
Yeah, now, and productivity, how it affects it, various organisms. I became oriented to plants when I was thinking about working on animals. And one lab that was very enticing to me was someone who was looking at how you control temperature in animals and how they perceive temperature and how do they regulate it. But that involved taking little rodents and putting implants in their brain, and they come out of anesthesia and they try to rip their implants out. And,
okay.
Yeah.
So plants, you don't have that trouble?
No.
Okay.
I've been bitten by plants. I at one time worked with cacti, and so they're not totally without their perils. But it definitely is morally a much more straightforward question. We used to have a bulletin board where I worked as a graduate student for reasons why I became a botanist. I hope I don't offend you, but we had I had an ad for a anesthesia testing machine. And what it was a hot plate in which you dropped a rodent and timed how long it took for it to jump. And I said, or we had also an ad for a mouse guillotine. So when you needed to sacrifice that mouse, and this is why I became a plant scientist.
Okay. So we're safely in the world of plants. Now we're going to fast forward to the first article that we're going to talk about when we talk about your research. And the listener's just going to hang in there with me to understand this as well, because I'm going to read them the title of the of the research paper, and then you're going to explain it to us in simple enough English, because I think the issues are terribly important. So it's called Manganese Binding to Rubisco Could Drive the Photorespiratory Pathway That Increases the Energy Efficiency of Photosynthesis. So I've read this over and we've talked about it a little bit. And what you're talking about is absolutely, I think, vital for all of us to understand, which is how climate change is going to affect plants. What happens to plants as their environment changes?
Correct.
So can you tell us in a sort of your, without any of these somewhat complicated words, what happens? I think this is of great interest to everybody now, which is what's going to happen to the plant life as the climate gets warmer?
Yes, I'll do my best. It's a complicated issue, and I'll try to make it so that it's palatable for the general audience. A portion of our atmosphere is carbon dioxide.
Yes.
And it's currently at 0.04%, and it is rising through the burning of fossil fuels. That's a piece of information that for which there is no controversy. So over the period of the last 30 years, CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere have risen 20% or more worldwide. Now, plants do something called photosynthesis, and what photosynthesis in simple terms is taking carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which is a low-energy carbon in carbon dioxide, and using sunlight to convert that low-energy carbon in carbon dioxide into a high-energy carbon in a sugar, such as sucrose or glucose.
That I vaguely remember from high school. Right.
Yeah. So you're still with me. Thank you. Now, what happens that since carbon dioxide is at such a low concentration, remember, 0.04% in the atmosphere, as that concentration increases, it makes it easier to do photosynthesis. So initially, people observe that the plants grew bigger and faster initially. Mm-hmm. But under longer exposures to elevated carbon dioxide, that stimulation disappeared. Mm-hmm. And the question was why?
Yeah, it's a good question.
And the answer was that plants are somewhat have a split personality. So they have to, when they take up carbon dioxide, the first thing that interacts with that carbon dioxide is an enzyme, a protein, mm-hmm. and that starts it on its way down the photosynthetic pathway, the carbon fixation pathway. That enzyme, which is the most prevalent protein on the planet, is called Rubisco. And Rubisco has a split personality. It can either take its substrate, which is a 5-carbon sugar, add a carbon dioxide to that, and make a 6-carbon sugar, such as glucose. Many of you know glucose. Now, but it also can facilitate another reaction where it actually oxidizes, burns that 5-carbon sugar, and releases CO2.
Mm.
That evil twin of photosynthesis is called photorespiration.
Mm-hmm.
And it was thought that when it burned that 5-carbon sugar and released CO2, that was completely wasting enormous amounts of energy, that plants were actually stupid.
And just burning off all this sugar they should have been converting into something more useful.
Like, fruit food for us.
Right.
For example,
mm-hmm.
Fruits and vegetables, grains and so forth. That should have been that energy should have been going into making energetic food for us to eat or for them to survive and propagate. Now, this photorespiration was seen as sort of totally wasteful, and it made no sense, though it has persisted for 1 billion years.
Hmm.
All photosynthetic organisms do this photorespiration, and it was always thought that it was something we should get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
And so generations of people working on plants and photosynthesis have been claiming that they're going to save the world by getting rid of photorespiration.
And make the world more efficient.
What happens, about 40%, 30 to 40% of the energy from photosynthesis is wasted, so-called wasted,
right,
in photorespiration.
Right.
What we discovered, it's not wasted. Plants are not stupid. They're just smarter than my colleagues. That they actually use the energy released in photorespiration to make protein.
Ah.
So they use that energy to take a low-energy nitrogen being an element.
Right.
That's necessary nutrient for all living things. And they take a low-energy form of nitrogen called nitrate, which is in the soil and plants absorb it in the roots. And then they make a high-energy form of nitrogen called amino acids,
mm-hmm.
which then make proteins.
So that's they're making proteins. And what is the relationship between which of the two things they're doing?
It depends on the relative concentrations of carbon dioxide and oxygen in the atmosphere.
Uh-oh. That sounds like you're saying something that could turn out to be dangerous. Because their balance is then based on something outside themselves in the air.
Correct. And as I've just mentioned, that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is increasing as a result of our burning of organic carbon and fossil fuels and releasing that CO2. And oxygen is actually going down, but oxygen in the atmosphere is about 21%.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going down very little, and carbon dioxide relatively is going up very high. So that initially causes more photosynthesis.
They get bigger. Plants get
bigger. But it inhibits photorespiration.
So they have more trouble making protein.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
So essentially, our plant matter is increasing in empty calories, starches, and less protein. So food quality is declining.
Food quality is declining. Let's say that over again, just to make sure that our listeners are still with us. Because they're just having more trouble making themselves into things that are full of good things for us to eat.
Like proteins.
Like proteins.
Right.
Right. So that we're talking about food quality there.
And food security.
And food security, because quality of food, of course, is related to security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I have we're doing some research now looking at the trends in, say, grain quality from wheat in California over the last 35 years. So it's not, it has occurred to an extent that we can now see how much this rising CO2 is affecting our grain protein. And I'm focusing on wheat here because wheat is a very unique food. 20% of the calories in the human diet comes from wheat, and 20% of the protein in the human diet come from wheat.
So it's a lot.
It's a lot. It is the major foodstuff in the human diet, plant matter.
So what have you found? Presumably you found is bad news.
Yeah, well, I don't like to be the bearer of bad news, but in this case, it is true that in California, the amount of protein yield, how much protein we're able to harvest from a given field, has gone down, depending where you are, and we'll go into that in a little bit later. It has gone down maybe 20%.
That's a lot.
It's
I'm shocked. I'm shocked to hear that, how much a decay that is. That's, you're talking, that's serious. I mean,
it's
that's
serious.
Not like 1%, 2%, that's
no,
20%.
It's a major amount.
So does that mean you would have to eat 20% more wheat to get the same amount of protein?
You have to eat 20% more slices of bread to get it. And this is not just us. This is the pests that are dependent on plant matter for their livelihood as well. So they're having to eat 20% more as well.
Mm-hmm.
And pest problems are becoming more severe, and the reasons for that have not been clear. Our work is showing why this is happening and what we should. I always make the analogy that often we're dealing with problems that are very complex, and there are no simple answers. But to approach a complex problem, we need to follow like a 12-step program.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have for substance abuse. And the first step of a 12-step program is to
admit you have a problem.
Yes. The second step in a 12-step program is to admit that we are responsible for that problem.
Mm.
The third step is to realize that the problem has dire consequences for the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth and through 12th step are to actually come up with a plan to address those problems once you get the first three steps right.
Once you've done that. Well, I want to go back to two things that I'm trying to understand and help our listeners understand. First of them, you ran by rather quickly. You said pests are having problems. So is that what you're saying, the same thing that humans have the problem, that the pests need to eat more grain, wheat, in order to get the same amount of protein? Or are pests just having a lot of problems now and we don't really know what they are? I mean, maybe it'd be, is it a bad thing when pests have problems? I mean, they are called, we do call them pests. I mean, can you fill that out a little bit better?
There have been things like forest decline. And a study came out about 5 years ago saying that the thing that's most related to the fact that there's more die-offs in forests and things like pine bark beetle have become more of an issue, the only thing that seems to be associated with it is climate change.
So climate change is just really affecting pests.
Pests, that they, since they're more voracious and eating more, they're destroying more of the things that we would use, say, wood, of grain, because they have to meet their requirements as well. And they're not under the same controls as we possibly.
Right. We can go out and get 20% more pieces, slices of bread, but they may be more affected. Now, the second thing you said was that it may depend upon where we are. You threw that in. So the idea is that presumably, I was in Patagonia this summer and there was no winter. There was no snow this year when we were down there. And so probably there's variation from place to place. Is that what you're saying? That in other words, wheat harvests in different places are having different experiences?
Exactly. And the reason is somewhat complex. And as complex things require some time to go through. So there are two major sources of nitrogen that we put in fertilizer that plants absorb from the soil
yep.
and then make into protein.
Yep.
One is nitrate, which I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. The conversion of nitrate into protein is inhibited by rising CO2. The other form, which is plants use quite readily, is ammonium. And it's very distinct chemically. And it seems like the conversion of ammonium into protein is not inhibited by elevated CO2.
Hmm.
The trouble with ammonium is that if plants absorb it, it's like a kid in a candy store, they'll eat too much of it because it takes too little energy to convert into protein,
uh-huh.
and they'll get sick to their stomachs. It becomes toxic.
Uh-huh.
To think about it, the most effective refrigerant is ammonium. And the reason we don't use it in our standard freezers, we use Freon and other fluorocarbons, is because if it leaks out, as they do in big chilling plants, it's toxic and people have to evacuate.
I see. So this is like plants become like pigeons, right? You know, who don't never know when to stop eating is what you're saying. I kinda, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Sort of like that. And so depending upon where you are, the plants will have different issues because of what the local area.
Correct. In the soil, ammonium is converted into nitrate by a certain soil microbiology.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, there is more nitrate. And that's particularly in warmer soils. So in warmer soils, particularly in California, nitrate is the predominant form of nitrogen available to plants. In colder sections of California, ammonium, the microbes that convert it into nitrate are less active, and so there's more ammonium. And the plants that are using ammonium, as long as it's not at high levels and they don't eat themselves sick,
they do a little better.
They do better, and under elevated CO2, they tend to be less affected by the processes of rising CO2 inhibiting nitrate because they're using ammonium as a nitrate source.
Uh-huh.
So our research is actually looking to what extent various species can use ammonium without suffering toxic effects. And we're looking, for example, at wheat to find out which genotypes of wheat are less sensitive to ammonium toxicity.
So they have a better shot. Those would be the ones you'd want to grow because you
particularly
would worry
about rising, them.
Particularly
yeah, under rising CO2 too. In the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. So if we step back from this all, which I think I actually have followed all the way through, so I really want to thank you for making that very clear. It does sound like it's a major challenge that the climate change is going to have a big effect on not only, you know, we know about polar bears and ice, but that actually just in general on food and food security, that climate change is going to have a big impact.
Exactly. And it's not just for rising CO2. There are many people sometimes call it global warming, that rising CO2, which is a greenhouse gas, and other greenhouse gases that are being emitted by human activities are going to cause a change in temperature. And we've observed this already. It is not controversial at all that on average, the global average temperature has risen 1 degree.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost, there are very few, there's one small place off the coast of Greenland where the temperature has not risen in the last under 50 years. But everywhere else on the planet, temperatures have risen, particularly in the more higher latitudes.
Mm-hmm.
So, such as in the Arctic and Antarctic, that those have risen by several degrees.
Mm.
And this is this has an effect on us. For example, we predict in the next couple of decades, the climate in Davis, I don't know how many of you have spent the summer in Davis, but if you have, you realize that there are times where it's
hot.
Yeah. hot, yes. And but the climate at Davis is probably going to be more equivalent in several decades to that in Bakersfield.
Okay, we hear that out there. So I'm curious if you could just give us a couple, maybe one or two other examples of particularly how food quality is going to be affected specifically by climate change. So one of them is that the food will be of less protein quality, and that's the wheat thing. Are there other kinds of things that simply with the increase in heat, are we going to find that we can't even grow certain kinds of crops, or what are going to be some of the other effects sort of on food production?
Well, Well, there's many other effects. It's not a one-word answer.
Right.
The decline in protein seems to be associated with decline with micronutrients such as zinc and iron, which is a major problem in many places in the world.
Less zinc.
Less zinc and less iron.
Uh-huh.
Anemia and so forth. And other micronutrients. It turns out elevated CO2 tend to cause a decline in all the nutrients in plants.
Uh-huh.
Because they're accumulating more carbohydrates, more starch, and less of these nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one nutrient that seems to stay stable, and that's why that title, which if anyone in the audience remembers the title, I'll give you a kiss, or at least a prize.
Right.
A kiss may not be a prize.
Right.
But that's manganese.
That does well. But a lot of the other things that we're expecting to find in our food are going to be of less quality.
Correct.
Right. Well, that's a pretty important point to make, I would say, there. And it's also something I can understand, that we're not just talking about protein. We're really looking at a general decline overall just in the quality of food. And that would be another way of sort of summarizing it.
And for those of you who are wine connoisseurs, as you know, that say the price of grapes in Napa and Sonoma is about $5,000 a ton for grapes. That same varieties grown in Bakersfield or in Fresno brings about $200 a ton. As Napa and Sonoma become more like Fresno and Bakersfield, of course, the value of the wine grapes there is going to decline.
Uh-huh.
And that's true for many of the foods that what we'll be growing, we can get a prediction of what will grow best by looking at places that are already hotter.
Uh-huh. Terrific. Well, believe it or not, that is the end of our first segment here on Office Hours. So when we come back, we're going to talk about Arnold's one-man attempt to get climate change out into the world by the online course that he's teaching, Climate Change Course.org, which is available for any of our listeners. And we're going to talk about what he's learned about teaching about climate change from teaching this course. So stay with us, and we will be back after a short break. So we're going to go ahead and start the second half of Office Hour today. We're talking with Arnold Bloom from the Department of Plant Science. And we've been talking about the effect that climate change is going to have, particularly on wheat and on some of the other crops. But Arnold has also put together an absolutely Herculean effort, which I've been enjoying very much, logging on and going along with the course. And this is an entire course in explaining climate change that's available for free to the world out there. So it's called climatechangecourse.org is the site. And when you log on there, as I've been doing, you get all kinds of information, lectures, then there's midterms, and there's reading that can help you work your way through and understand climate change better. So the first question that I want to ask you is why you took on such an incredibly complicated task. I mean, this is a huge job. I've done a little bit of online teaching myself, and it's an amazing job. So why did you decide to make a free climate change course available to the world?
Money. No, it was.
No, I knew that wasn't going to be right, right?
Yeah. Well, it's not actually completely wrong. So I was on campus. I was interested in how plants were responding to rising CO2 levels.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, there were no courses on campus about climate change. It was about 16 years ago. There were some on climate, some on weather, but climate change was not being really handled. On this campus.
Huh.
So I stepped into the breach. I taught that for about 5 years. And I was talking to a publisher who had published some of the textbooks that I had written. And he asked what I was teaching, and he said, well, and finally I said, I'm teaching a course on climate change, and he said, you should write a textbook on that.
Mm, mm.
And I did, based on that. And some people at National Science Foundation got a copy of the manuscript and said, well, we'd like to get you involved in a nationwide program doing something about climate change and climate change education. And I said, okay, I haven't focused on education per se before, but I had colleagues from all over the country who were trying to start similar courses. They could use my textbook and the materials I had open to the public. And I was helping them start online courses about climate change. And I said, well, there were no real online courses at UC Davis that why don't I just, rather than helping other campuses develop this, why not do something for the campus which has nurtured me and in my professional career.
So you decided to do it at Davis, for the Davis. And this was, you first launched it in 2012. Is that the first time the online course?
It was earlier than that. It was 2011.
2011. Okay.
Yeah. And of course, there were some birthing pains, but as one does something that's new. But students are quite forgiving as they're magnificent in terms of they'll work with you as long as they realize that you are
trying. Yes.
And
yes.
Giving things your best effort. Mm-hmm. And so the things got improved as my skills improved. And it was a labor of love. And it's been used all over the world. Sections. I made it on a public site, and it's available to anyone who wants to look up climatechangecourse.org. And now I have a multimedia textbook that's free that we're using, and you can access it through that same link.
Uh-huh.
And you can go through, and it not only has pictures, but each picture has a little video that's associated with it. It has data manipulations. It has quiz questions with it.
Mm-hmm. Pretty neat. So how many people do you think have taken your climate change course and now are walking around in the world with armed ready to fight climate change? Do you have any idea the total number?
I have exactly an idea because been doing a study on the efficacy. The course is taught both online and in person, or face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are contrasting the performance of students who take it in one form versus the other. And so over the last 7 years, there's been 2,000 students.
Mm-hmm.
And about 50% have taken it in one form versus the other. And we're contrasting how well students do depending on format. And this is of increasing importance because though the topic of distance learning is what they call it in the trade. That can be online courses.
Right.
It can be correspondence courses. Has been controversial since it was first done about a century and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been no really rigorous studies that have compared the efficacy of different formats.
Absolutely. So it's kind of interesting to me that you started off to talk, really the goal is to teach people about climate change. But in the process of doing that, you've ended up gathering a lot of data about just what fits in the sort of theory of education and educational delivery along the way. Though this was, I presume, not what you had started this whole project for. Or were you aware of that you're also doing sort of comparison shopping about how do we teach people in the future?
I was aware of that.
You were aware of that.
That had the potential. Because, in fact, 30% of undergraduates in the United States will be taking an online course,
uh-huh.
even if they don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, are we doing them a service? Or are we doing something that is actually counter to human nature?
Uh-huh.
And the answer is...
Okay, what is the answer? What is the answer? Well, I'm sure we'll be able to unpack it. And I'm sure the answer is not yes or no, right? It's going to be more complicated than that. I imagine that they're both somewhat successful with some slight differences.
Yes, there are. And in fact, there's a very distinct advantage to either format.
Hmm.
One is that for online courses is something fairly obvious if you have just tried to get in a course of that suits your needs and also fulfills the requirements that you need. That is that scheduling an online course, which you only have in my course, there's only one set hour per week that you have to schedule for.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a choice of 12 different times.
Wow.
And so the other things can be done at, on your own schedule. So students, we've had a number of students that have had constraints in terms of family responsibilities, employment responsibilities, and this really increases access.
Okay. There are just some people for whom flexibility of study is the necessary condition for studying. In other words, they can't really take advantage of certain kinds of things without having that flexibility. And for those people, it's a big win.
Also, if you would like to graduate in normative time, which is theoretically 4 years, having a course that meets your general ed requirements and allows you to fit into your schedule is imperative.
Yes.
And
yes.
So it really does have advantages that way.
Okay. So what's the downside of with the online courses? What have you found?
We've found that in looking at these 2,000 students, about half have taken in either format, and this is collaborating with some wonderful people on campus to do educational assessment, is that that on average, and accounting for different language abilities, accounting for different students being of different ethnic groups, accounting for seniors versus first, whatever a senior is nowadays, versus first year students, and accounting for transfer students, and accounting for students on financial aid, that on average, with the, all those things accounted for, students do 3% less on a scale of 100. So if you took the face-to-face course and would get a 95%, like an A, you are more likely to get about a 92%.
Well, that's
online.
A sobering moment for you faculty out there listening to this show, because that's what we're worth. We're worth. Interfacing with us live time is worth three points out of 100. I imagine that's a fairly sobering point to make to faculty, don't you think?
Yeah, well, I always say that what I found is students like me dead or alive, but they preferred me dead. That is, that many students will take me online because of the convenience. And so sacrificing that 3% may be just something you're willing to do. We find that students are willing to do because of the convenience of it. And yet the penalty is not great.
Do you have any idea why that is? What is your best guess as to why people who take the same course online do a little bit less worse? Is there something, is it the human, what we call transference and psychological, you know, this kind of the attachment theory that makes you do a little bit better, or what?
Well, we think that it takes a more self-discipline to keep up with the work. If there's not someone 3 times a week saying that this is what's due today and this is how you should do it. So we find that there has to be a little bit more self-responsibility. And also students who take the course online may be taking it because they need they have other outside responsibilities.
They may be more busy or something like that. Because
yeah.
I'm sure that the online course also gives you a structure. So it isn't as if you're in free fall on the online as opposed to it. So well, that's very interesting. And I suspect as you go along, you're going to be doing more on this. So stepping back from this now, I mean, I think it's such an issue now in America today, in the world today, to try to get people on board with climate change. And it seems to be a rather difficult challenge. And I'm wondering what insights you have gained from doing this course and putting it online. Do the people, if you take a course, do people come out of the course educated enough to be able to really be what we would think of as responsible citizens? I mean, is the course effective in that way? And, you know, and then what can we learn from that effective lesson in other parts of life? Those are two big questions.
Yeah. Oh, you make the premise that anyone who gives you a simple answer to a complex question is not being honest with you. And so climate change is a complex issue. And we try to give you the details of the complexity thereof so that you can make your own decisions. As I state right off the bat, I am not going to focus on the political science of the issue. Over the 16 years I've taught it, the political venue has oscillated back and forth between governments. What is interesting now is that I think particularly among young people, there is an understanding that this is an issue that's important to them. They're confused about many of the facts involved in climate change, And that's what we try to give them, not alternative facts, but the best information that we have so that they can base their opinions on those. And there's not simple answers. We give a student, say, the final exam has one essay question. And that essay question, what would you do, if anything, about climate change? Mm. And there is no right answer. You can say we should delay doing anything because the technology is improving so much that the solutions we'll have in 5 years will make things much more economically feasible. Other people say we shouldn't delay at all because in 5 years things will be so much worse that we'll need to take action now before it becomes over a threshold.
Well, it seems to me that's a little bit fancy for maybe a little bit obfuscating some of your goals. Presumably, you do want people to believe in climate change at the end of the course. I mean, whether or not you say that there's a simple solution, you do have a certain kind of investment in the issue, in the way you've structured the class.
I think most students come up with a clear that they're, as I said, the first three steps of our 12-step program are clear.
Mm-hmm.
That is it a problem? Yes, climate change is a problem. Are humans responsible for that problem? Clearly, humans are part of the problem, if not most of the problem. Third, will have dire consequences for humans and quality of life. Yes, those first three steps, I think, are not controversial.
Right. Well, within those three, do you think that the students that you teach in this class primarily already accept those 3 points and are just taking the class to learn more? Or is your tool actually useful for helping people make three steps in the 12-step program?
It varies a lot among students. We have a diverse student body, thank God,
mm-hmm.
and it depends on their background. I think the vast majority of students are somewhat confused.
Mm.
That is that they have heard different things from different sources, and they're taking the course to sort it out as any, I call my students the intelligentsia. As part of the intelligentsia, the reason they're taking the course is that they want to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
we give them the opportunity to find the best information that I've been able to find mm-hmm. without a real agenda.
Well, that sounds to me like you're saying they haven't taken the three steps. They are really pre-3-step, and that part of what then does happen in the course is that they kind of can, through learning the information and working through, they can kind of mobilize their first steps in a very concrete way by making these three confessions of your 12-step program.
Yes. It varies quite a bit. Some students have a very clear idea on what they believe when they enter the course, and that may persist. And yet there's a good number that have heard contrary information from various sources.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, I think that's changing because there is more and more information that's very clear-cut, and the experience of people themselves, like if you talk to your parents or your grandparents, their experience is that things are changing
right.
at a rate that nobody anticipated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So over the 16 years, the actual facts are becoming more evident to all concerned.
Right, exactly. So what do you say then in terms of, if you were talking to somebody else, encouraging people? I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of listeners out there who are interested. This has been a big week of news about activities around climate change. So, in terms of this as a tool, I know you think it's important for scientists to get out there and put their information available for the public. So in that way, it's part of a more, would you say, you were talking about a more broad-based need for scientists to explain to the world like this, to get on radio shows and to explain things, to make online courses, because of the huge gap we find in America today and other places as well, between what scientists are studying and how average people sort of understand or think about science.
Yeah, I remember when I was an undergraduate, you'd be sitting in a dining hall with people who were studying diverse things, and the last thing you would talk about is science.
Hmm.
You might be talking about religion,
mm-hmm.
or you might be talking about things that were more accessible to the public in general. I think it's now the time that it's no longer can we rely on expert witnesses to tell us what the science should be or what sort of courses of action we may have at our disposal. It really is, we need to have educated populace. And I think we have more and more people are getting secondary degrees and even further degrees. And those people, the intelligentsia, have to explore these issues themselves and come to their own conclusion and take appropriate actions. Now, one problem with, I make the analogy that climate change in many ways is like dealing with spiritual matters, because often you're dealing with things that are in the long term, mm-hmm. that extend before beyond a single life. You're talking about things that have moral questions on what do we owe as an environment for our descendants? How do we, what do we owe to them? Do we have a obligation to be good stewards of the planet, which is a tenet of many religions? There are things that we will not see in our lifetime, and we act to have to anticipate what things that maybe have various degrees of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in many cases, those types of questions are interlaced with one's spiritual beliefs. That's why I know this is something that you deal with professionally as well. And so it's interesting to see how different denominations have dealt with the question of climate change. And one always has to bring to mind that people have, it's called a limited pool of worry,
mm-hmm.
that we can only worry about so much at one time. So, for example, you may be worrying now what you're going to eat for dinner, or hopefully not, but you may be worrying about where you're going to sleep tonight. In mm-hmm. some countries, that's a even in California, that's a concern of many people. And in that case, you may have less time to in your pool of worry to consider what's going to happen a decade from now mm-hmm. or 20 years from now. And so you can put that, I'll worry about that tomorrow because today I have to worry about where I'm going to sleep or where I'm going to eat dinner or how I'm going to deal with a friend in crisis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it is something I'm very empathetic toward that, yes, climate change is important, but it has to be on a list of things that may be important.
Mm-hmm. So what would you, for those people for whom it is important and who have decided they want to get involved in it, I think it's been frustrating often because it's hard to just do educational things around climate change. It seems hard to make a headway in American society. So I'm curious whether you think it seems like it's hard to convince people that climate change is real. And so I'm curious whether you have any lessons for us that you can bring back from your experience with this. I mean, you say, you know, everybody can think it through themselves, but I think it's actually a very hard thing to for those of us who are not scientists, for example, to think about how do we actualize education around climate change, or just trying to have an intelligent conversation around climate change. I mean, maybe what we should be doing is making a little cards with your website on it and with your course and saying, you know, this is too complicated for me to try to bend your ear on right now over a cup of coffee. And we just need to flood the California with climatechangecourse.org and get more people on, you know, who becoming more familiar with the basic science. But I wonder, I don't know, I'm just curious for your thoughts on this.
We had I and a group of people from campus and off campus had an article in Educational Journal talking about a major source of carbon is academics traveling to meetings.
Huh.
So that two round trips, air travel via airplane cross country generates more carbon per person than a family of four in their other activities.
Mm-hmm.
So we advocated that we do more national meetings via webinar. I have more regional meetings that don't require such long distance travel, and that we be concerned about how we conduct our daily lives as to reduce our carbon footprint. We have all the students in this class do a carbon budget for mm-hmm. themselves.
How do they do that?
There are very clear steps. We have a list of activities and what the carbon footprint of those activities are, and they check off what things they're doing and to what extent they're doing them, and they come up with a number. And the following week, we ask them how they might reduce that carbon footprint by 30%. And they all have something that they feel they can contribute. And so, no, it's not just being passive and letting the events unfold without being active about it. We're trying to get people to think about how they can be involved in an effective way.
Well, I think those are really good examples. I really appreciate those. And I want to linger over them a little bit, because I think what it does is it's quite striking to me that you're doing the climate change course, which is sort of the idea. Let's take education as the way to talk about climate change. But you're also saying, let's just pinpoint people one at a time and get them to look at their own life habits, which sounds something more like something that might happen in my class, right? Without necessarily, I mean, this is just, you don't have to have too much of a knowledge of the high level to be able to understand everything that you would need to understand in your course. The kind of saying, well, we're also talking about climate change is individual responsibility and individual calculation, that you, finding out what you use, how much, what your carbon footprint is, and then dealing with that. So I, you know, maybe there's some way to for us to think about how you do that. You say you don't have to take the whole class, but maybe this is, would you say this would be one sort of nugget that you take out of that's more easily accessible and more, here we are on the radio, we can tell everybody, not everybody on the radio is going to take a climate change course, because it's just, it's a bigger commitment than, though I hope many of the people do go and sign up for your course, and I'm enjoying it tremendously. But what you do then is you can take that little sort of nugget, and that's what Arnold say, you take the nugget of, as one possible way of thinking your own life about climate change.
Yeah, the course has three major components. One is the causes of climate. The next is what the consequences of this climate change that is occurring may be, both for the physical environment of the Earth and also sociological and psychological and economic implications of those changes. And then the last one is solutions. And so what are the technologies to both to adapt to climate change and to mitigate climate change that we can take? And what's really keeps me very optimistic is how over the 16 years I've been teaching, that these solutions, which once seemed very expensive and very impractical, have become commonplace, can actually be done at a, there's no reason why we're not doing it.
Well, that's really a wonderful, optimistic thing to say for as we near the end of the show. So tell us a little bit about what you mean by that. What's become so much less expensive?
Well, in terms of alternative power sources, the major carbon emitter in developed countries is electricity generation.
Okay.
Alternatives like wind power, wind turbines, and solar have become economically competitive, actually less expensive than coal, which is the dirtiest of methods of generating electricity, despite what you may hear. There is such a thing as clean coal. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
The pilot plants have failed, and the costs triple when you try to get clean coal. So it, not only is it coal itself more expensive than these alternative neutral, like wind and solar. And in California, we have, just in our area, we have close proximity to all these alternatives. We have 7% of our power is generated about 60 miles from here, in Geyserville, by geothermal. That's 7% of the electricity in California. We have hydro. We have all these things that are practical, economical, and the reasons for not doing it are strictly vested interests.
Well, I think that's great. I think it's, I think it's very important, again, sort of talking about, as we're now in the area of sort of psychological approaches to dealing with climate change, in addition to educational approaches, learning enough about climate change to get passed through a course. So as you say, you understand things like the history of climate change, the causes of climate change. I think one of the problems with it, sort of from my point of view, is the despair issue, that people feel very overwhelmed by it and not are not sure what they can do. So I think it's really useful for us to sort of summarized at the end that you are an optimistic. Here's an optimistic person. Here's someone who's been teaching climate change for 16 years. And you come here and you say there are good available things that can be done. You can go out there and you can do things. You can stop going to as many meetings, and you can also use alternative energy sources. And there's, in other words, the third part of your course is very robust on solutions.
Yes. I mean, the course at one time had the nickname Doom and Gloom with Bloom.
Okay.
But the alternative, Hope and Dope with Bloom, doesn't quite rhyme.
So, right.
So, no, I think they're, particularly for the current audience, that learn what you can, and you'll find that there's many alternatives that will make the world a better place.
And one place to learn this all is then in your class. So one more time, we're going to thank you very much, Arnold Bloom, for coming from Plant Science, coming on to, I learned a great deal and I'm very proud of myself. I'm going to go back and read this article on manganese binding. Now that we've talked about it, I'm going to try to understand it. So I want to thank you very much for coming on the show today.
It's been my pleasure.
Yeah. And as always, you can listen to the show again. In case you want to get to understand this article, it's probably worth hearing twice. It will be archived on officehourucdpodcast.com, officehourucdpodcast.com. You have to wait a little bit before the show is archived, but it will be available. You can listen to other shows. And also, we will have a link there to the climatechangecourse.org. And I hope that that's a lot of homework. Sometimes we give little bits of homework at the end of the show. Now we're giving a whole course to take.
Well, yeah, but it only means your future on this planet Earth.
Right, exactly. Only
the stakes are quite high.
The stakes are high. So go ahead. I hope some of you look at the course. It's very interesting. We will be back next week for another office hour. So this is Professor Jay signing off. And in the meantime, stay tuned for Radio Theater, which is going to come up next here on KDVS. We'll be back next week and we'll knock on another door. Bye.